Since the late 19th century, the Savoy Theatre and Savoy Hotel have been absolutely central to the mythology of London, a place for the rich and famous to be wined and dined and entertained, to see and be seen. At their height, the family behind these establishments, the Doyley Carts, were considered the greatest impresarios and hoteliers in the world. Now, I was familiar with their role, for example, with Gilbert and Sullivan, more of that later, but I didn't realise that they were also in the pub business. Over the course of three generations and a century of prominence, their own story, however, faded into obscurity. It's now been revived in the first ever biography of the family, written by Olivia Williams. The book is titled The Secret Life of the Savoy, and Olivia joins us now to tell us more about it. I hope you're actually broadcasting from the Savoy on this occasion, Olivia.
Hello, Philip. No, tragically not. I'm in my own home, which is a lot less glamorous. The Savoy isn't actually open yet. It's got another week to go.
Oh, okay. The last time I was there,
coming out of lockdown.
The last time I was actually there was with David Putnam when we were both in the film business, and David seemed to conduct his entire film companies from within. I was surprised to read that no one has written a biography of the family before. Has this been for lack of trying?
No, a few people have tried over while they were alive as well, so over the 20th century, but because they were very private people, they battered off a lot of offers to have their biography written up. And also the board members of the Savoy felt as though it wouldn't be that flattering for the family because they had quite an unhappy private life, and it was felt that that probably wouldn't really reflect that well on the hotel and on the theatre, so they thought it would be better off just to leave it behind closed doors.
And the family themselves were content to operate behind the scenes?
Yes, I mean, they were all quite... So Richard was the first successful one, and he was gregarious and loved publicity, but then his son and his granddaughter were very shy, and they were really happy just to literally, you know, enter and leave through the sort of stage door and not go in through the front and not have their pictures taken or anything like that. And a lot of people within the theatre and hotel industry didn't really know anything about them other than the name. So yeah, they were more than happy not to be famous.
Your blood must have frozen when you learnt that Bridget, the last of the dynasty, was burning papers and had others dumped into skips.
Yeah, I was. that was made my job a lot harder. And I think people who worked there at the time when it was happening, particularly with the things going to the skips, they obviously felt sad about that as well, because a lot of them, I mean, they didn't fish out anything very private, but mementos that they wanted to keep. I've interviewed a lot of staff members who have then brought something out of their cupboards to show me that they actually fished out. So I think there was, fortunately for me, there was a bit of a grab when these things were thrown out.
Yes, I must say, Oliver, the thought of you headfirst in a skip is absolutely intolerable. Now, you tell the story through three generations. Let's start with the Victorian patriarch, Richard.
Yeah, so he was the son of a professional flute player and he started off life in Soho, which at the time was a pretty run-down, lively place to live as a child. But then his father became much more successful when he went into manufacturing musical instruments rather than playing them. So then the family became quite wealthy by the time that Richard Doyley Cart was a teenager. And his father wanted him to follow into the now family business of manufacturing musical instruments. But Richard Doyley Cart fancied himself as a composer and wanted to write lyrics, and his dream really was to create English language opera. But then he wasn't that successful at doing that himself. So then he had to pivot to look for some people who were better at doing it than he was. And
before we plunge into that, his name should have been Richard Cart, but his father had added an E to the surname to distinguish himself from another flute player. And Mum added the middle name Doyley, a Norman name from her more illustrious side. I love that.
Yeah, I think when people haven't read much into the family, I think they assume because of it, them having such a grand sounding name, that they must be from some ancient noble family. But Richard Doyley Cart was just lucky that his parents sort of played around with his name a little bit. So he had something a bit more exotic sounding to start off with.
As a result of our discussion, I'm going to rename myself Philip Doyley Adams. I think it's got a nice ring to it. So let's move on to the Gilbert and Sullivan era. Tell us about how that happened.
Well, once Richard Doyley Cart realised that his career as the composer of operetta wasn't likely to take off, he was about 30 and he was a talent agent, and he was newly married and he was really looking around for some money spinners. And he went to an operetta that was written by Gilbert and Sullivan, but it wasn't a big success and it got some pretty bad reviews, but he thought that there was maybe something in it. And so he went back to them and persuaded them to work together again, this time with much more success.
Now, the Gilbert and Sullivan story has been well told on many an occasion, and we all know that William Gilbert was a former barrister, and the young classical composer Arthur Sullivan, brought together by the dynasty, when, in the late 1870s or early 1870s?
Yeah, so the play that the operetta that Richard Doyley Cart went to see in the early 1870s, and then by the time they got their act together, it was by the mid-1870s, so these things took a while because he didn't really have the money to put on these performances himself yet.
But with the Doyley Cart Opera Company, there was a desire to pioneer what would be an original form of entertainment, the English light opera.
Yes, so they managed to do it with Richard Doyley Cart, needed some financial backers for that to begin with, because he couldn't afford to put it on as an impresario in his own right. So they finally managed to get all the money together and put it on in a very low-grade theatre by 1878. But then Richard Doyley Cart really wanted to cut loose from the other backers of Gilbert and Sullivan, because they were getting very jittery about whenever the performances started to thin out a bit. They always wanted to pull the plug on it and he wanted to keep going. So then he decided to set up just the three of them and split the profits between the three. And this turned into some legal wrangling with his former investors. So they were in and out of court until the 1880s, trying to establish who owned the copyright. But eventually he was able to put on the Pirates of Penzance, which, as we know, was a huge hit, and the money from that and the Mikado helped him to build the Savoy Theatre, which was his home for Gilbert and Sullivan. It was he wanted not only an opera company, but he wanted a home, a permanent home for that opera company.
And the three worked together for the next quarter of a century. But despite the professional chemistry that we know about, you remind us that Gilbert Sullivan and Doyley were a very combustible trio.
Yeah, I mean, from reading their letters, it seems to, there aren't that many periods when they're actually getting on, because Richard and Arthur Sullivan were very close and they spent a lot of their private time together. They used to go on holiday together and they were very good friends, whereas Gilbert, I think, always felt a little bit left out. But he really didn't spend much of his sort of free time with either of them. And whenever there was a bust up between William Gilbert and Richard Doyley Cart, Arthur Sullivan always took Richard's side, which obviously annoyed Gilbert even more. And then in the end, we get to this infamous carpet quarrel. But I think...
Sorry. Tell us about the carpet quarrel.
So Richard Doyley Cart, having had all this success with Gilbert and Sullivan with light opera, decided that he wanted a serious opera house that he wanted to build and own himself, and that he wanted Arthur Sullivan to start writing proper classical music rather than scores to go with Gilbert's humorous lyrics. So he built this English opera house that opened in 1891. And that really diverted his attention from the Savoy Theatre. But when Gilbert went away on a very long holiday to India, and he came back and he found out that Richard had charged the three of them rather than paying himself for the Savoy Theatre's new carpet. And Gilbert found that unacceptable. So he weighed in, and as a lawyer, he felt very confident that he was in the right about it. So he weighed in to say that while Richard Doyley Cart was getting distracted with his new opera house, that he should be concentrating on the Savoy Theatre, and that this carpet expense was unacceptable, and that Arthur Sullivan and him shouldn't have to pay for anything to do with the theatre because the theatre was owned by Richard Doyley Cart. But then Arthur Sullivan, being loyal to Richard Doyley Cart, instead of backing Gilbert as he had expected, declined to do that. So then the three of them fell out acrimoniously and they went to court. And then really there were quite a few years when it was just Arthur Sullivan and Richard Doyley Cart working together and spending time together, and Gilbert didn't see them. And to try to patch things up, Richard Doyley Cart sent Gilbert some tickets to the Gondoliers, and William Gilbert didn't come. So it was pretty frosty for a few years between them.
I'm talking to Olivia Williams, and her previous book, which we didn't discuss, we should have, was Gin, Glorious Gin. She works as a freelance writer living in London, and the book we're discussing on this occasion is The Secret Life of the Savoy. So when you write that they were locked in a struggle for money, acclaim and creative control, you point out that while success eased the tension, it never dispelled it, and new tensions were forever brewing.
Well, yes, so Richard felt underappreciated by Gilbert because Gilbert was always needling him about how much money he was making, even though he wasn't part of the kind of creative, in inverted commas, part of the trio. And he resented how much money Richard Doyley Cart was making. And then Sullivan was frustrated because he wanted to write classical music, but he was very successful writing these scores for Gilbert's lyrics. So he was frustrated. And he also he didn't like that Gilbert tended to write the lyrics and the story first, and then he had to write the music to go with it.
But Richard did a lot of Richard did a lot of very interesting things, because he poshed up the entire theatre going experience, didn't he? He ran the bars himself, giving the most careful attention to procuring everything of the very best quality, unquote. The programmes were artistically presented mementos. What else did he do?
Well, the whole atmosphere that we recognise now and think is normal didn't really exists before in the theatre in London, before Richard Doyley Cart instigated it. So the idea that you would be silent during a performance and that the lights in the auditorium would be off so that you would be concentrating wasn't something that British audiences were familiar with, because they used to chat all the way through and the lights would be on and they would, you know, maybe go to the bar, maybe come back. They were vying really on stage for the audience's attention while they were busy doing other things. So the idea that you sat down and concentrated in silence was new. And also the seating plans, that it wasn't a first come, first serve fracas outside the building, which quite often ended in scuffles. Richard Oilycart didn't want that as his theatre, so he had seating plans on the back of the tickets, and people had to buy their tickets in advance knowing where they were going to be sitting.
Okay, I know the hotel is still under COVID restrictions, but take me there now and tell me tell me about this great London institution.
Well, like the theatre, Richard Oilycart wanted to bring to London something that he thought was lacking. So he was going on tour with Gilbert and Sullivan around Europe and America during the 1870s and the 1880s. And he was becoming increasingly frustrated that when he came back to London, he didn't really see all the same options for eating out and for places to stay. So he was putting together, while he was travelling, he was putting together his idea for what the ultimate luxury hotel would be like. And then he spent a good few years putting that together. And the result of that was the Savoy Hotel. And it was a pretty anxious time for him because he didn't really have any examples in London of what he wanted to do. So he didn't know if it was going to be a success and he didn't know if people were going to come. And so he had three parties to launch it of varying scales. And he used all his contacts from the theatre industry to get a sort of lively bunch of people there at the beginning. But then his trouble was really if you could picture how big the Savoy Hotel is, trying to keep that place full all the time.
Well, of course, he ran it like a great theatrical production, didn't he? He staged everything. And I like the way he got the staff to really make it five-star by having them record everything from the guests' preferred porridge temperature and mattress firmness to diagrams of how they like their toiletries laid out in the bathroom.
Yeah, there are lots of nice little details that he put in there that were not necessary. I also like the...
not necessary? The bare minimum.
For the public rooms, they also put in all these unnecessary flights of steps so that people could make an entrance when they came in, which I thought was nice too. And they had sort of strategic table planning so that you could do plenty of people watching from wherever you were, and they put the most sort of exciting people who are coming into the restaurant in the middle, and then everyone else around the outside could watch them having dinner. And thinking of pink tablecloths because it's more flattering to ladies' skin, and providing a quartet so that there are no awkward silences while people are eating.
The attention to detail is fabulous. Front of house staff were expected to read all the daily papers to understand their guest lives better.
Well, alongside their preferred porridge temperature, etc., they also made notes about people's achievements and who their family members were, who they usually came with, so that there was a sort of seamless feeling that every time you came to stay or you just came in for dinner, that the staff would be aware of how wonderful your career had been and that kind of thing. So they knew how to ask you ingratiating questions. And I think from talking to a lot of the staff who worked there, I think one of the things that they like about it is that so much was expected of them. So they had, they had a lot of pride in their work because they were expected to be up to date with current affairs and to know who everyone is and how all these illustrious guests might know each other.
Well, let's look at some of the flamboyance made available to these popular or these distinguished guests. You could get the courtyard flooded to 4 feet to conjure the Grand Canal of Venice. You could have baby elephants pulling 5 foot high birthday cakes. Heavens above, they stopped at nothing.
Well, yeah, I think that's part of its longevity and its success probably is that the banqueting department, which dealt with all of these one-off events and celebrations, was so theatrical and well run. I think that really started that momentum of having big public celebrations at the hotel, because one of the other things that Richard Doyle-Carte wanted to change was that in the 1880s London, people used to entertain at home, and he really wanted to get people into the habit of going out to eat or celebrate their wedding reception at the hotel, whereas people just used to do that in private before.
So talking about things that were happening in private takes us to the odd scandal. Oscar Wilde calls the Savoy's first.
Yes, well, he was also slightly entangled in a roundabout way with the family himself, because he was one of, so Oscar Wilde was one of Richard Doyle-Carte's earliest clients in his talent agency. When he was looking around for talent to promote, he found a young poet called Oscar Wilde. And so he organised Oscar's, really his big transatlantic trip that launched his career when he became famous in America.
So where he said that, where he said, "I have nothing to declare except my genius."
That's the one, yeah. So he was already a family friend. So then when Richard Doyle-Carte opened the Savoy Hotel, it was not surprising that Oscar was one of the guests. But then he brought with him Lord Alfred Douglas, who was his much younger lover, and they spent months and months racking up huge bills at the suite that became infamous, because then Oscar became entangled in a legal battle with Lord Alfred Douglas's father, and the whole thing proved his undoing, because that's when he went to jail in the end, and he died in obscurity after that.
Well, Oscar died in a much cheaper hotel, that's for sure. So, look, we've got so much to talk about, so little time. I want you to talk to me more about Bridget, who was, we last saw, chucking the family papers into a skip.
Yeah, so Bridget was not intended to take over. Her, she had a younger brother, and it was assumed that he would take over from Rupert Doyle-Carte, who was Richard's son. But Michael, her brother, died when he was 21 in a car accident, and that left only Bridget to suddenly be thrust into the limelight and take over when her father died, which no one had expected to happen. So she felt pretty daunted, because unlike her brother, she hadn't been groomed for it since she was little. She had just been married off to her cousin, which had gone badly wrong. And she had, which, and it was difficult to do in those days, but she had managed to get divorced. She came back. She had a bit of a loose end. And then her brother died, which meant that she then was expected to take over, which she did. And she was quite a conservative figure, so I think that was part of the reason maybe why the hotel managed to sort of stay as it was for such a long time.
I'd like your description of her. Well, she's slight and solitary. She hardly ate, drank whiskey, and smoked 80 Du Maurier cigarettes a day.
Yes. She lived in the hotel because she never married again after the first one went wrong. So she just lived in, after her father died, she moved into his suite in the hotel. And she was there from 1948 until 1985. I don't know how she filled her evenings, but she was very shy, and a lot of people who worked at the hotel didn't even know what she looked like or who she was exactly. So she managed to kind of stay under the radar in the hotel. And unfortunately for her, she didn't have anyone to leave her interest in the hotel and the theatre to. She also ran the Doyle-Carte Opera Company as well, which she inherited. So in the end, it just became a family business without any family to leave it to. Otherwise, I'm sure they would have stuck at it to this day.
Olivia, do you think the Savoy or the Ritz is the greatest London hotel?
It would be very disloyal of me to say the Ritz.
But it's got a similarly spectacular history, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it's on a much smaller scale, and also it really followed in the wake of the Savoy, because it was Richard Doyle-Carte who brought César Ritz to London, so the Ritz wouldn't exist without the Savoy. So I'm going to go with the Savoy.
What's the cultural legacy, do you think?
Well, I think just really setting the template for what we think a luxury hotel is, because it was one of the earliest, and it could have been done in hundreds of different ways, but that we have that template that goes back to 1889, I think, really shapes our idea of what a luxury hotel should be. And a lot of the American 20th century hotels that followed, they asked advice from the Savoy management about what to do and how to run them. So I think they really created that whole culture of the luxury hotel, if you like them, and I think they contributed a lot.
Well, when we can travel and I finally get back to London, you've got to take me to the Savoy and we can spend some of the immense pile of royalties your book is going to earn you. Olivia, thank you for that. Olivia Williams, the author of The Secret Life of the Savoy, a Hachette publication.